so serious.
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game? Yeah!
Welcome to the Toy Department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, we're finally back. It's time for another Toy Department. I'm Derek Madden. He's Matt Kolsky. Feel like it's been a minute, man. How are you?
It has been a minute. You were traveling. You were doing interesting, exciting things, I'm assuming.
I went to Louisville for a music conference.
I like that you really gave Louisville its appropriate pronunciation there.
Yeah, well, you know, I used to live in Kentucky, so I know they take this very seriously. Yeah.
Yes.
In the process of that, there's like a music industry softball game, which I was very excited to dominate.
And how'd that go?
Show off my skills. First at bat, struck out.
Nice.
It's in slow pitch softball, but
that's good.
But second at bat, redeemed myself. It just cracked a line drive into the gap, and so I'm taking off. And immediately I'm thinking three bases, if not four, right? So I'm running pretty good. We had these like makeshift bases, like first base was like a plank of wood, basically. And I did what you're supposed to do.
That sounds dangerous.
I did what you're supposed to do, which is, you know, step on first base. First base went right out from under me. I ate it, pulled my hamstring, limped myself to second base, stayed in the game, came around and scored, and then immediately checked myself out. So
not what you want.
That was the end of my softball. It was the beginning of the trip. I literally couldn't bend over or lift my knee much higher than maybe, I don't know, like I could sort of lift my leg a couple of inches off the ground, which makes it super duper hard to, you know, do things like get dressed, get undressed.
Right. Sure.
I didn't wear socks for 3 days because I just couldn't put them on.
That's terrible.
Yeah, it was pretty much a disaster. And here we are a week later, and the hamstring is still bothering me. So I'm doing this podcast standing up because sitting is kind of still uncomfortable.
Hamstring injuries are the worst, you know? If you ever have one, you immediately understand why it's such a bad one for professional athletes, because it just nags, and you like re-aggravate it constantly because you can't not if you're moving around.
Yeah, and that's the thing, right? You're on it all the time. You know, you're constantly using your legs, and it feels like it's never gonna go away. Like I'm gonna be worried about this when I'm in the gym a month from now. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's just
because it feels sucks. Like just the slightest tweak, and you can set yourself back another week or two.
Yeah. So. You know, not good
been
times.
Been there, man.
Don't get old.
Yeah, that's the best advice you can give anybody.
But on the plus side, we have a chock full program today. Like, there's a lot going on. I guess maybe because we're in a music mood, we listen to a bunch of stuff, and we'll get to that. But there are a couple television finales, really some epic enders to, I think, you know, a couple of shows that we've been kind of diving into all year. Which would you like to start with first?
Let's do the one that aired first. Let's go Better Call Saul.
All right. I loved the Better Call Saul finale. Where were you on this?
I loved the whole season. I just thought this was clearly the best season. Not that it wasn't very good already. But I thought this season of Better Call Saul was Breaking Bad level television. It continued to be so well made and acted as it was in the first two seasons, and well planned as well, because there's a lot of plates in the air in this show, especially considering that we know the future. And I thought this year it added even more like intensity and drama to that blend, if you will. And it was fantastic, and the finale was no exception. I'm ready for the next season to start in a week. Unfortunately, it's probably going to be like a year.
Yeah,
but
there's more and more depth to the show every year, and you know, much like Breaking Bad, you can see how it's set up now that you know next year is going to go even deeper. You know that there's all of this stuff with Gus and you know, Hector Salamanca to explore. Mm-hmm. Really, the season kind of relatively light on Mike Ehrmantraut. So, you know, there's going to be more of that. And, you know, now we're fully into Saw land. And you know that at some point there's going to be the dissolution of this relationship with Kim. And so it's like, there, you know, there's all of this ground to cover.
It's so funny that you mentioned that relationship, because as much as the drug violence that has crept into the series has made it dramatic and intense, like, I spend a lot of time watching this show on edge, waiting for something horrible to happen with Kim. For a second, for a split second, and slight spoiler alerts happening now, but for a second when she crashed, I was like, oh my God, is she going to die in a horrific car accident? Because, like, in order for him to go full Saul Goodman, don't we imagine there has to be something tragic with Kim, whether it's just the dissolution of their relationship or her being taken out of the picture in some way? Like, something has to go really bad there for Jimmy to stop being Jimmy.
Yeah, I think I envision some sort of conscious uncoupling being thing. But it is interesting, and I totally agree in that you are sort of waiting for something bad to happen to her, and yet when that crash happened, it completely caught me off guard.
Oh my God, I jumped in my seat. That was so well shot. That was so well shot. In terms of the, you know, the feeling of, like, you think you're cool and then you drift off and are jarred awake in the car. That's like a terrifying nightmare for me.
I don't feel like we're actually spoiling anything, too, because that was in the last episode, if I'm not mistaken, the actual crash.
Well, I mean, right. It's a spoiler from a week and a half ago, but still semi-spoilerish.
But, you know, that's another thing about this finale, I think, that, you know, and really when you laud this show, like the direction and the direction of photography is so good, and you have you know, these shots of, like, you know, Jimmy and Kim on the road where she crashes, and Jimmy's out there, like,
picking up the
papers, and, like, the landscape, it's so well framed.
Mm-hmm.
That you can just look at it, and the show does these things I don't know that anybody is really doing, these long, dialogue-less set pieces set to music. And, you know, obviously I don't think it's just spoiling it to say, but, like, the, you know, the Chuck breakdown scene.
Mm-hmm.
It's just
in the finale. Yeah.
It's just gripping television, and there's there's no words, you know. It's essentially a montage in the way that, like, you know, a Karate Kid training montage would be, except done so well and so, like, you're just riveted. Hats off to those guys. You know, I mean, you knew they were good hands, but you didn't know it could be Breaking Bad level good, and I think we're headed there.
Yeah, and I, when you talk about those set pieces, the Chuck breaking down and smashing his house up is a obviously great example, but there have been ones with Mike, you know, setting up the drug dealers and just, like, all these sort of silent set pieces they've done this year, which it seems like four or five at least. The sort of concert and quantity of different elements that have to come together to make a scene like that work are so impressive. because, like, Michael McKean is incredible in that scene, and it's shot and framed incredibly well, but also, like, this breakdown was, and the style of it and the way it happened was conceived at some point, you know, presumably by Vince Gilligan. So, like, everything is planned and executed so well. And I think, again, that has always been a hallmark of this show. But the stakes have seemed to rise with every passing season.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And by the way, to deliver that on the heels of that speech to Jimmy.
Right.
You know, these two Saturday Night Live, like, you know, comic actors.
Like, it's crazy.
Just crushing that scene, and there's so much intensity and emotion in it. Like, wow. Yeah, it's just it's great television. It's great television.
Yeah, it's really just great television.
And I think, you know, sometimes people with this show get a little bogged down in, you know, thinking that the action is low stakes, you know. Saul's in a guitar shop trying to convince the Sklar brothers to buy ads. You know what I mean? And
right.
Like, really, this is what we're watching? But you just know that it's going to 11. And you, like, right. You sort of have to be on that ride, you know?
It's funny. A friend of mine who you know, Shannon Kaler of the Stone Foxes, was playing me their gave me their new album that comes out in a few months to check out. And there was a song on it, I hope I'm not speaking out of turn, but oh well, that is like just this very slow building rock jam that doesn't totally have a chorus, but like starts quiet and just builds and builds and builds and has this incredible intense payoff.
This sounds like 75% of national songs, by the way.
Yeah, but the Stone Foxes play hard blues, not like emo.
Yeah. Emo.
Whatever. Can we not argue about the national again? It's well, we can have this when we talk about the Fleet Foxes later. You can hear me excoriate a band that people like. But the point of this analogy was just that in the first verse, if you want to call it that, or second verse, where it's sparse and there's a quiet drum beat and, you know, sort of plinking guitars. And like, if you can't see the intensity of the slow build, that's your problem, not Vince Gilligan or Better Call Saul's problem. Like, there is intensity in human moments. There is intensity in stakes that don't have to have a gun or a pound of meth involved.
Yeah. It's a delicate art, and I, you know, it's something that, and I know you're not really, I don't really know where you are in the show, if you've even bothered to continue down the path, but like, this is the kind of thing that, yeah, this is the kind of thing that I think people were expecting from this season of The Americans, like, you know. This slow
build.
But
it's not delivering, correct?
But it didn't, yes, it did, you know, it wound up not really paying that off. And you realize that it's, you know, it is hard to walk that wire. And when you fall, it's a big time disappointment. So, you know, I commend those guys from a degree of difficulty standpoint.
Yeah, and The Americans is a show that has incredibly talented people working on it who've done great things. But I think it really shows you, you know, and I think we can probably say a similar thing about Noah Hawley, that The people who can execute television, I think Genji Kohan is another person I would throw in this category, who can consistently execute television at this high level, it's very difficult. It's very rare, and like, it's not as, oh, another show as we think.
Right. You know? And not only that, I think you almost have to really continue to execute it at an even higher level each time.
Yeah,
because when you're a show that
expectations rise,
right? When you're a show that's been around for a few seasons, just the natural instinct is to call it old hat, you know.
Right.
And I think that, you know, maybe as we transition, that Fargo certainly dealt with that this season in terms of people's reaction to it. We talked to you know a few pods ago about the idea that people had that this is just, you know, more of the same, you know, now we see the template and this is what it's going to be. And it feels a little rote. After watching the finale, I feel like it's really hard to stake that position.
I would think so. I mean, again, this is another one. I just thought it was a great season and a great finale. There were times when I doubted the finale, actually. There were times when I thought it was going to end and leave me unsatisfied. But they, you know, they sort of did an epilogue that really circled back around. And I think, you know, there are people still who didn't feel like this was as good a season as the others. And I don't know what, I don't entirely know what to say. You know, I thought the acting performances this season, I mean, Mary Elizabeth Winstead is like my new favorite actress. She was just so awesome, and the finale was no exception in that regard. Ewan McGregor, although the accent came and went, I thought played both parts well. And then Carrie Coon and David Thewlis.
I was going to say, we got to mention Thewlis. Like,
I mean, these face-offs they've had now.
By the way, we should probably just go ahead and spoiler alert this whole conversation. Because we're going to get it. We need to get it to the end of the show at some point. So.
Yes. So, you know, watch the finale of Fargo and do that before you listen to the rest. But my God, I mean, again, you talk about intensity in quiet moments, you know. These, I think there were two of them over the last few episodes where Carrie Coon and David Thewlis are just sitting opposite each other in like a hall of mirrors. I mean, it's just a police interrogation room, but the way it's shot, you see them reflecting infinity number of times off into the distance in the mirror.
Right. Well, but you know, it's interesting to me that you know, the earlier in the season when they face off the Stussy offices, it has that exact same feel. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Yeah, because it's the like glass door thing, and it's just like, it's like when you know, in a music video or like a very stylistically inclined movie where like you sort of have two people, and then the lens kind of fisheyes, and everything around them is darkness now, and they're just like in their own world. Like, that's the feeling that's created, and they're very quiet scenes where no one says anything directly or overtly threatening or anything, but there's just this menace about David Thewlis and this very sturdy resolve about Carrie Coon that, I don't know, man. Like, if you don't like watching that, I don't know how to talk to you about TV.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I agree. It's just fun. But I would also say, you know, to me that this season wound up being the most unique, I feel like, of the three seasons in the way that you know, the first two, you could sort of reliably figure out that the, you know, the stoic good folks were... Mm-hmm.
They won.
Yeah, they were going to win. And the people who were in over their head, you know, were going to pay their price. And that the, you know, the bad guys were going to have vengeance delivered upon them. Mm-hmm. And I think this really broke that up. And, I think there's some ambiguity, even like
absolutely
is and I'm blanking on his name, but the deaf guy, you know what I mean? Like, is he a good guy?
He's been in all three seasons, by the way.
Oh God, you're right. Yeah.
The only character who's been in all three seasons, oddly enough,
I guess ageless in a way.
Well, no, because he's a kid in the second one,
right?
But, yeah. Interesting quirk,
you know. But yeah, and
but
I
yeah, think, you don't you like a who is good or bad is a little less clear, and B, like, where they end up is a little less clear.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, there's the scene at the dinner table with Ewan McGregor and Michael Stuhlbarg. I don't know. It's like this happy family dinner, but it's very ominous, right? I mean, everything is left in a very, like, I don't know if open-ended is quite right, because it does tie up most of the loose ends, but it's just, you're not, it doesn't have the clarity of the other seasons necessarily. Yeah.
Well, you could certainly also, you know, think a lot about what happened, you know, after that bullet hits Ewan McGregor's head there. You know what I mean? Right. That's never really shown.
That's what I'm saying, is like, the beyond the, I mean, right, obviously it's ominous because he gets shot in the head, but that, like, he looks happy, right? But that family dinner seemed like the edge of insanity to me.
Yeah, oh yeah. It feels a little unhinged, and not just because they have a Jell-O salad. Which
gets a salad.
Which, by the way, like, I, you know, now living in Minnesota,
this is a real thing.
I have a new appreciation for the way that this show nails some of the finer lifestyle details of of this town. And that is certainly one of those. That is a very real thing that people do here. That's a very real thing that people would eat at that dinner. And, you know, I mean, I think that's part of what still makes this show feel Coen-y in a way. You know, it understands the landscape. You know, it uses that. And it's interesting because I don't know. Did you read any of the Alan Sepinwall conversation with Noah Hawley?
I did not.
They talked a little bit about how that LA episode was maybe a portal for them trying to figure out, you know, if there are other options or, you know, other ways to tell the story. Basically. I don't, you know, and Hawley was like, he didn't think that they could ever, like, fully leave Minnesota.
Right.
You know what I mean?
But maybe spread their wings a little.
Yeah. And it did also give, you know, because he's also talked a lot about he doesn't know whether he's going to be able to come up with another season.
Right.
You know, it does give you some hope that that there may be another installment of this.
Yeah. Along the line. I mean, you know, even if it's just, even if our Noah Hawley experience is now Legion, like, this is just a guy I trust to make great TV. I mean,
yeah.
I think he also, and you know, you mentioned the Coen brothers thing. I thought this was actually probably the most Coen-y season. Not necessarily, I'm not talking about story or anything like that, but like the way it was shot, it felt like to me there were a lot more direct allusions to like Coen brothers style shooting.
Yeah, there's also some classic cinema references that go right over my head, which I think is a Coen thing as well.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah,
but I'm just even thinking of things like in the finale when we first sort of see the IRS agent in the finale, and just the way the camera sort of zooms along his papers and like it just it felt like an introductory shot in the Hudsucker proxy or something. You know what I mean? It just like it jumped straight, and there were a lot of things, not to mention several direct Big Lebowski like shout outs. I believe there was what was it? It was one of the famous lines got used a few times. It was not the Chinaman is not the issue, but something of equal.
It wasn't this rug really tied the room together either.
No, but it was one of those level of lines. I can't believe I'm forgetting now, but I felt like there was a lot of like wink, wink Coen brothers stuff in this season. And just because I'm a huge fan of them, I did enjoy that.
Yeah. And you can tell there's still that appreciation that underlines this. I also think there are less characters in this season than some of the other seasons, which I thought was kind of interesting. All right, so let's talk about the end. You know, because obviously the show is set up almost choose your own adventure style. In your mind, who is the guy that walks through that door?
Oh man. I honestly don't know. It could literally be any character we've seen, right?
Well, I think it's either a policeman or a very powerful person who's going to let David Thewlis go, right? I mean, I guess there's a third option that they're both wrong, but
well, right. I mean, it could be, first of all, do we even know the door opens? Like, do they just sit there for 10 minutes and then she goes, well, I guess no one's coming, buddy. You know
right.
what I mean?
Like, yeah, all right, sorry. Like, I suppose that's a fourth option that no one ever comes, but
right. I mean, what do you think obviously happens? Someone would eventually come, yeah. But like it's not like we see the door open. She's just staring at the clock, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I almost wouldn't be shocked if the you know, if like a deaf guy with a gun comes through that door. Like it's so but I mean that sort of is the that's the beauty of the ambiguity we're talking about is like, yeah, it's choose your own adventure style, but it's also like I'm thinking now of the line in when Will Ferrell in Old School is trying to describe thinking about a strange woman's underwear. And it's like maybe it's a thong. Maybe it's some sort of cool thing I don't even know about yet. That's what's been crazy about this show. Like, I will tell you, I certainly did not expect Nikki Swango to like simultaneously die and murder that cop.
Yeah. No, I was like, oh man, she just killed a cop. How's she gonna get out of this?
Right.
I was like, oh wait, she's not. She's not getting out of this. Yeah.
Oh damn.
Also so, beautifully like, shot, by the way.
You know, at this point, I don't know that we have any reason to believe that David Thewlis is super connected. Because when Mary Elizabeth Winstead, Nikki Swango, challenged him, he basically was like, all right, you called my bluff, here's your money. So if I had to, like, reason it out, I say he's going to jail for a very long time.
Couldn't "you called my bluff, here's your money" just mean, like, you can have it until I kill you later, you know?
Yeah, I guess, but if he was so connected, because he creates the impression, right, that he's the right hand and speaking voice of some master criminal. But she says to him in that lobby scene, I can tell you're the boss. And so that doesn't mean he's not connected.
Yeah.
But I do think, like, when you think about his actual behavior, or the way he got Ewan McGregor to do the crazy stuff, like, he never actually wielded anything but threats.
Well, to Ewan McGregor, because at that point, you know, he'd seen them throw a guy out a window, you know what I mean?
Sure, yeah, no, I mean, threats that were rightfully scary. Yeah. Don't get me wrong.
Like,
I'm not saying
they backed up
a
lot
McGregor's
of action. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Well, he backed it up with those two muscle guys.
Right.
But ultimately, two muscle guys is a pretty easy hill to overcome. I think the bigger threat that he had was like the perception of clout, right?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, like, they also hijacked a bus full of prisoners, you know, and
that didn't really work. Like, they weren't very competent.
Well, that's because they got DJ Qualls in the mix. But
yeah,
if if you're asking me which of those things happened, I think Thewlis's version happened, because I do feel like in this show he's generally operated in with impunity. You know what I mean? In without much punishment.
And he has, but haven't you seen? I think that's been as much a result of incompetence from the other side as him actually showing any real, you know. Again, when I'm saying real power, I'm not talking about a couple of like dummies with guns,
right?
Or in fact, smart guys with guns for the most part. I'm talking about like the sort of political connection that gets you a free pass at the Department of Homeland Security.
Right.
That's a very different level of.
But I mean, I guess that's what I'm saying. Is kind of up until that point of that, final interview. It didn't seem like any, that law enforcement was even really close to dealing with them, right? You know, like that. You know, they were around in some interviews, but that was it. You know.
Yes, but I would have said that was a small-time criminal relatively small-time but intelligent criminal operation counting on the incompetence of tiny, small-town police officers. But that being said,
foiled by Minneapolis Department of Homeland Security.
fair point. But I do think the fact that this can be such a hot debate is what's great about the way the show ends.
Yeah, and look, and it was designed to do that. And, I think it was designed really as sort of a Rorschach test, you know, in terms of, you know, the person that you think wins probably says a little bit about your view of the world. At least
that's right, you sick son of a.
Right, well, you know, I'm couching that in that my answer is, this is my view of this world, of the world that this show is set in. I don't necessarily feel that way about the world at large.
Don't worry, we'll get there.
I'm not saying I don't. but yeah, I'm judging it on the universe of we're watching a television, which is a universe with magic bowling alleys, and so it's not.
Can we talk about that?
Sure.
Who was that guy? So for people who watched and don't remember, there's a scene after the prison bus crash where Nikki Swango is trying to escape and stops in a bowling alley, and a guy talks to her in a scene that is eerily reminiscent of the scene in The Big Lebowski where the dude talks to Sam Elliott. And it he seems to know all about her situation. He hands her a cat that he says is actually her dead boyfriend, and then sends her on her way, essentially. But then
a cat that, by the way, she completely believes is her dead boyfriend.
Right. But then he's also there when the guys chasing her show up. And he talks to them as if he is a boss in the criminal conspiracy.
Yeah. So he's not necessarily a figment of imagination, right?
Well, that's what I can't figure out. That's the most mysterious part of the show to me, even more so than the crazy cartoon episode. I believe that was the episode where there was a lot of voiceover and sort of overt storytelling. So was he like a plot device or was he real? I think is one of the most interesting questions about this season of Fargo. And if he's real and somehow involved with the criminals, why did he send her on her way?
Yeah, that, I don't know if there are supposed to be answers to that.
No, I mean, I definitely don't think there are, but I do think it's fascinating, and I do think it's a testament to the quality of the show and the sort of intriguing twists and turns of the narrative that at least you and I were perfectly comfortable with that.
Yeah, no, and it's sort of what you expect from the show, which lives in our world, but occasionally drops a UFO into it,
Right. Exactly. But the UFO was interesting too, because I'm not sure we had any choice but to take that UFO literally, right?
Yeah, no, you have to, right?
I mean, its physical presence affected a dramatic change in the narrative, right? So, you have to take that UFO literally. I'm not sure. And that actor, by the way, who played the guy in the bar,
Ray Wise is his name.
Is one of my favorite
character TV actor Ray Wise. he's been literally a million things.
Yeah, and he plays a really wide range while at the same time retaining a certain smirking evil.
Yeah. Actually, it's not literally a million, but he has 229 IMDb credits.
It's pretty good.
That's a lot. It's a lot.
Yeah. It's not bad work if you can get it. but yeah, he's one of my favorite people to see pop up in small roles like that. And he's perfect for this sort of thing where it's like, is he even real? Is he the devil? Is he an angel? What's happening?
Yeah. Normally he plays smarmy, but, that translated very well into wise,
Mm-hmm. Well, but smirkingly wise, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I know something you don't know and I'm only telling you part of it.
Right. Yeah. I forgot he was Robin's dad on How I Met Your Mother.
That's right. He's Robin's dad on How I Met Your Mother. He's in Twin Peaks, at least in Fire Walk With Me, if not in the show. He did play the devil, actually, in a goofy little TV show I really liked called Reaper.
I remember that. Yep.
And just a million, every damn.
Yeah, he's done every Law CSI and 24 stuff, sure. And all of those.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Before we get too deep into the career of Ray Wise, should we swing it over to music?
Yes. We went heavy on music.
We listened to a lot of stuff.
What is it? Was it five albums we wrote down?
I've got six. Six.
Okay. So without listing them, of those six albums, I am very interested to find out which was your personal favorite?
All right, so we listened to, we should probably run these down so that people understand.
I guess. I was going
to
say just give us your favorite before we run them down, but well, go ahead.
But I mean, we should tell people what they are so that they, you know. Right?
Yeah, that's true. Okay. I see what you're saying.
All right, so we listened.
These are the sorts of programming decisions that we should make ahead of time.
Yes. We listened to the new Fleet Foxes.
I believe I directly rejected the idea of making this programming decision ahead of time, by the way. anyone's wondering how we got here, go on.
We listened to the new Fleet Foxes. We listened to the new Alt-J, the new Young Thug, Phoenix, Portugal the Man, and Lord.
There we go.
And I think that my favorite of those was the new Young Thug.
That doesn't... You said you thought your answer might surprise me. That is not the most surprising answer that you could have given me. I'll say that.
Well, I eliminated one because we talked about it last night. You know, in terms of being able to surprise you.
Right.
But definitely surprised me. It was not the one I was looking forward most to checking out.
Okay, tell me. I'm excited to talk about this Young Thug album. So tell me why you liked it.
I just, and maybe it was a condition of some of these other records that I listened to. Mm-hmm. But I just found it to be, I mean, look, it's skillful. It's, you know, it's diverse in some ways, but
he is such an interesting and diverse talent. But yeah, go on.
Like, I just found it to be really joyful and pleasant and fun and authentic and all of those things. I, you know, like, was a breath of fresh air in the palette of some of these other records that we're going to talk about.
Totally agree. And I would add to that, musical. I mean,
sure.
It's weird, and he is so bizarre, but he can give you bars. He can give you straight bars like a normal rapper with a normal voice. He can give you his, like, weird alien raps. And then he's got, like, weird singing things that he's doing that, you know, it's like, and I've never really necessarily said this about a hip-hop artist before, I don't think, but I think about, like, some of my favorite blues singers or rock singers are guys who couldn't be like choral singers or opera singers because they're not, they don't have perfect pitch or whatever, but there's some character in their voice that makes it interesting and so when they sing in a certain way, it doesn't matter if they miss a note a little bit. And look, Young Thug is not Mariah Carey, but
on so many levels.
Yeah, but he's doing something that I think he is aware of and in control of as a musical artist. And it impresses me. Now, you know, I think you do. There's a massive grain of salt because the subject matter and lyrical content is the same trap stuff you've heard on any trap rap album you've ever bought.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, if you're not familiar with the man's oeuvre and you're thinking about checking this record out, you do need to be prepared for the presentation of sex in just the crassest way possible.
You know, literally, I mean? The crassest. Although
this is a man who will rhyme, suck, and fuck completely unironically.
Correct. And what's
like, he just discovered that
they rhyme. I think he hits moments where he feels like he's taking it to like a sensual crooner place.
Yeah, and he's
but
not.
That's,
he's not.
But that's still the vocabulary remains. So like I don't want to call it willing suspension of disbelief, but it's something related to that.
Yeah.
Where if you're like an intelligent, educated person and you want to listen to Young Thug, you have to say to yourself, I'm not listening to like musical poetry. This is not about insightful lyrical content.
If you've ever used the phrase sapiosexual, this record's probably not for you. But, but
that is a hilarious way of putting it, but you're probably right. And it's not, you know, whatever. I do think probably on a podcast that's not called The Toy Department, there's a really interesting discussion to be had about the fact that even young people in certain genres are married to regressive content. And that's complicated, but
yeah, that's a very non-toy department discussion.
That's what I'm saying. But I do think, in the same way, I think there's value in, you know, in the same way that I can divorce myself from the lyrical content of the Rolling Stones' Brown Sugar, I can do it here. And I think if you're able to, you're right. It's fun. It's diverse, it's bizarre. There's moments of almost country music on this album, and there's moments of hardcore trap rap. And in a lot of ways, the beats and backing music, I think if you just pulled Young Thug off it and threw, you know, Ben Gibbard on, you're like not that far off from a Postal Service album or something. It's interesting and weird and kind of cool. And
I kind of wish mashups were like still a thing so that someone would try that.
Yeah. It would be funny.
Yeah, the production on the record is very good.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
So was that your favorite record as well?
No. It's probably – it's in the mix for like second and third, fourth, that area. My favorite record is cut above the rest for me of these six. And it's the Portugal the Man record.
All right. Well, tell us what you liked about the Portugal the Man record, and then I'll go.
All right. Well, you clearly did not like the Portugal the Man record. I really like this band, first of all. I think they are, you know, I just talked about sort of the idea of pushing music forward in some ways, and I think they're doing that with indie rock music. They're not married to conventions of the past. It's not a retread. It's interesting music that's combining a rock sensibility with electronic elements and sort of hip hop, sort of bass and beat feel at times. They do interesting things both melodically and like in terms of time signatures and in terms of like what the different singers are doing with their voices. I just think they're a band that keeps it fresh and makes good, interesting songs.
Okay. I disagree with literally everything you just said.
Really?
Yeah. And I'm going to – all right. So, you know, for context, Portugal the Man has a song on the radio now.
Which one's on the radio?
It's called Feel It Still, and it's doing very well. It's doing very well. So, like, I didn't get that song. I found it to be kind of annoying. And so I, you know, like, people ask you your opinions about stuff. You're like, eh, you know, not for me. But it turned out to be a hit, and I could, you know, a hit's a hit, and I, you know, I recognize that. So I'm like, all right, I'm going to come into this album sort of with the idea of, hey, maybe I'm missing something on this band. And I put it on, and do you know how, like, sometimes you hear something and you instantly know, like, oh, yeah, this is my shit?
Mm-hmm.
I had, like, from the opening strains of this record, which the first song is this.
The first song has a slow start.
It's this, like, Richie Havens sampling Woodstock thing. Like, mm-hmm. I knew immediately, this is not my shit. Like, I found this record to be such hippie garbage.
Really? I don't think of it as hippie-ish at all.
I cannot stand the guy's vocal. I cannot stand their wow. approach. I found it to be kind of like this. You know, the record's called Woodstock, I think, and it's this sort of
it's
like
called Woodstock.
Yeah, yeah, it harkens back to the 60s in this way that is like the least interesting way you could possibly do it. It's not like psychedelic or interesting at all. Like, they're all of these pop flavors that are melded together, but in a way that doesn't blend. It was such a struggle. So wait, I listened to it twice.
Had you not heard Portugal the Man before this?
I have, and I realized that I'm like, I've never liked this band, and I've seen them in concert, and I didn't like them then either.
Really?
It's just not for me. I don't like anything they do. And I feel that in
this is such a strong reaction to a band where I would have guessed that you're like if you I didn't think you were going to be a huge Portugal the Man fan, but I would have guessed that your floor on them was like, whatever.
Yeah, that's what it's kind of like. That's what surprised me. I didn't expect to hate it. It struck me on as offensive on like a visceral level. You know what I mean?
That is hilarious
like,
to me.
I listened to it twice. It was really a struggle to get through the record both times. Like, times. Like, we're going to talk about this Fleet Foxes record in a minute, which I know you hated, and I can understand why.
No, but see, hated is the wrong word, I think. Okay. But yeah.
I would much rather listen to that front to back than this Portugal the Man record. Much rather.
Yeah, I mean, right. I can understand that if let's transition.
And
into
I didn't like that
right
record
now.
Either, as we'll get into.
Yeah, but so. let's do it right now because I think that's a perfect transition. Even though I completely disagree, and that record being on makes me want to like do violence. I get what you're saying because if it's anything, the Fleet Foxes is listenable in the same way that like the Lapping Tide
like,
is listenable.
like a new age kind of
like Enya, like in the same way
like
that,
like those like whale sounds that you put on at night when you're trying to go
exactly
to sleep.
Right. That's what the Fleet Foxes are. They're musical ambient.
Now I'm just curious before we get too far into this.
It's like a collection of Simon and Garfunkel B-sides.
Have you had any experience with Fleet Foxes prior to this record? Okay.
Yeah, no, I mean, and you know what? The first time I heard Fleet Foxes, my response was probably, oh, that's pretty. You could put that on if we're, like, trying to take a nap on the beach, you know?
Now, I think,
but,
I think
like,
they have...
How many times? How many times do you need to take a beach nap?
No, and that's fair. And I, you know, was excited to listen to this record, A, because it's getting good reviews, and B, because Fleet Foxes have a couple of songs that I think are brilliant. White Winter Hymnal is just, to me, a fantastic song. And, you know, not maybe so sleepy. It's not. It's definitely a Fleet Foxes song, you know what I mean? But it's got a gorgeous melody, and they're capable of these sort of moments of extreme, unironic beauty. Help This Is Blues is another great Fleet Foxes song. I almost called them
okay,
Fleetwood.
But at their best, aren't they kind of like an acoustic poor man Sigur Rós at their best?
Well, you're talking to a guy that the phrase acoustic
I know
poor
I
man Sigur Rós would be broadly appealing. No,
but they're
I don't,
the worst version of that.
I don't.
Just,
I would rate them certainly higher than that. However,
it's like, let's create a soundscape with our acoustic guitars. Well, congratulations. But I honestly believe that at least 30% of people who gave this album good reviews would not actually be able to tell one song from the next if you like tested them.
I think there's a fair amount of those people. Yeah, I would agree with that. And this record to me lacks any of those kind of beautiful moments. It's mostly spurts of 20 to 30 seconds of extreme beauty, punctuated by long, long stretches of abject boredom.
It really is some of the most boring garbage I've ever heard in my life. And again, like, that's why I don't want to say hate, because, like, hate implies the sort of strong, visceral reaction you had to Portugal the Man. Yeah. I literally just, like, I sit with this music on, just thinking, oh, God, I want to skip forward like 30 seconds. Like, when does it get good?
Yeah, like, just get me to the good part. There is an 8-minute and 45-second song on this record, and this is not a band that does enough things to ever write an 8-minute song.
No.
You know?
It really is.
I mean, even a guy like Iron and Wine, who I could see you
No, but see, there's a difference. I'm never going to listen to Iron and Wine, but I have great respect for that.
I like Iron and Wine. And Iron and Wine has some 8-minute songs, but like they're 8-minute songs like in the way that Dylan writes a really long song where like the lyrics twist and tangle and turn around and, you know, and there's this build thing that's happening with the music. And
this is another thing. Like that sort of stuff, even the best parts of that sort of stuff, I don't often love. You know, Bon Iver, Iron and Wine. I respect and recognize the quality of those guys. I'm not putting it on, but they're saying things and they're speaking to you in the style of, as you said, Bob Dylan. There's so much damn reverb on the Fleet Foxes that it sounds like they're just trying to either cover up poor singing or make sure you can't understand the lyrics at times. And it's just like, hear us. It's like
it's hymns. That My Morning Jacket, it's, like grain silo vocal production. You know what I mean?
Right, but without any of the interesting musical stuff that's going on with My Morning Jacket.
Yeah, like
I thought of that actually. That's exactly what I thought. Is like it sounds like if you took all of the interesting music and just had Jim James singing over like Mumford and Sons.
Mumford and Sons, I think, is way more dynamic musically than this band is.
And that's a great word, by the way, dynamics. That's what I look for in music. Yeah. Give me fast and slow and loud and soft and surprise me. Don't play your acoustic guitar on medium strum for 55 minutes.
Yeah. It is a gently punishing record.
Like, that's a great way of putting it.
It's really hard to do. It's really
hard
to do.
It's very well said.
And I think the reason, you know, to get back to something.
It's an assault with pillows.
Yeah, it's an assault. Like, not even the ones that you, like, sleep on, like the throw pillows on your couch. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Totally. The tiny soft ones,
But, like, and to get back to what you were saying about, you know, critics liking this record, I think a lot of this is this sort of sense of, you know, there's something authentic about these guys. And I fully reject that notion that a bunch of bearded guys from Seattle have somehow lost touch with modern times. And totally this is their expression of, of that need to reconnect with some sort of past folk thing. Like, to me,
honestly,
a Young Thug record is 10 times as authentic as this is.
Oh, I completely agree. And here's I'm going to almost – maybe this is a step further. Hearing this makes me feel like I understand what happened to Father John Misty.
Interesting. You know Father John Misty was in this band, right?
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, okay.
I'm saying I feel like he spent so much time around these guys, and then he was like, this hipsterism is wildly absurd. And I'm going to take it to its – logical or illogical, absurd extreme.
And just comment on it. Yeah, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
By the way, he played drums in Fleet Foxes, which seems to be like just, can you imagine a less, you know, necessary appendage for a band is playing the drums terrible. For Fleet Foxes? Just banging like, that bong, bong.
Whoever's thing. Playing drums in Fleet Foxes right now is so sick of playing with brushes and hot rods, believe me.
All right. I feel like we should move on. By the way, Father John Misty did tweet out that he really enjoyed this album. Should I get the chance to talk to him? Because occasionally he runs into my orbit now. I'm definitely going to ask him why.
Honestly, like, because you can remember the way I didn't love his album, but at least it was something.
Yeah. I mean, you didn't love this album, but I think it's fair to say that you loved it a lot more than this. Yeah. All right. Let's jump into you want to talk about the Lord record?
I do, because by sort of a word association, I'm gathering you didn't like it much. I thought so the albums while we're here. Fleet Foxes, I thought was terrible. Portugal, or not terrible, but just nothing. Portugal the Man, I really loved. I think all four of the other ones, Young Thug, Lord, Alt-J, and Phoenix, all are kind of, I at least enjoyed elements of all of them.
Yeah, that's actually where I'm at on the Lord. I enjoyed elements of them.
I think the highs on the Lord record are spectacular.
I would agree. I'll tell you.
Jack Antonoff, I think, is a national treasure as a producer.
Yeah. See, now I'm going to go the other way on that. And my my fear, particularly, you know, because Green Light was the first song from this record, and I think that's a wholly unsuccessful song.
Well, I kind of like it.
And then the next song that came out was Liability.
Yeah, that one's a ballad. But.
Yeah, which is a ballad, but also a very Antonoff-y song. And I had extreme fears that Jack Antonoff had broken Lord. I thought he had taken Lord and sort of ruined it. And you know, to me, the quality of song on this record is directly proportional to how much it sounds like a Lord song versus how much it sounds like a Bleacher song. And the ones that sound like Bleachers, I do not enjoy. The ones that I'm like, oh, there's Lord again. I like Lord. Here's what Lord's
so
doing.
I'm guessing then that my favorite song might be your favorite song because it is Homemade Dynamite.
Yes, that's excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that line in it is great.
And those are the moments. You're right. The moments, but I kind of, I'm giving Jack Antonoff the benefit of the doubt, I guess, but... there are some Bleachers-y moments that don't totally work. I agree with that. And Green Light, I thought, was one of the more successful of those. But I kind of felt like even in something like Homemade Dynamite, the production feel was – I don't know. I think he's good at that particular pop thing because even though Lord is a little – is quirky and a little off-center, she's – clearly, her goal is to make pop music. She's definitely making pop music. And I was talking to my friend Jordan Cruccioli, who writes for Vulture, about this, that it's almost like she's making pop music, but she's making minor pop music, you know, as a key, as opposed to major. And I feel
100% agree with that. Yeah, 100%. I think it's a great way to put it.
Because so much of our pop now is so, so very major. It's all bright colors and sounds and... you know, chords that make your ears smile.
Mm-hmm.
And Lord is just, she's pushing a little harder doing, and I think that's why Melodrama is a great name for the album, is like, that's kind of her thing, is she's musical melodrama.
Yeah. I think there's a real space too, by the way, for that, for people who are making pop music that's maybe a little more off center. I think of like a Sylvanesso, whose latest record is really like, they went bigger, but they're still quirky, you know what I mean? And there's a nice pocket in that for people who don't just want to hear Chainsmokers and Haley Steinfeld and
Katy Perry or whatever the
hell. Yeah. Well, apparently no one wants to hear Katy Perry anymore. Yeah.
Well, that's Taylor Swift's fault, I guess, right?
Well, I think the Antonoff thing, at least for me, I like Jack Antonoff the person a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, we're big Lena Dunham fans here. Like,
yeah, you don't like Bleachers?
He seems like a good guy, and I recognize that there certainly is some musical talent. I think
have
fun,
you seen
had
him
a couple
live?
Great songs. I've not. I'm gonna in a couple weeks.
I recommend it. So I'm interested to hear what you say about that.
But I think his musical output has not matched the massive amount of hype that he's obtained. And I've generally been disappointed in the songs that he's done for other people.
Interesting.
So
I think I disagree with that, but I will say that I do agree that the best moments of this album were, I'm not going to say Jack Antonoff has nothing to do with it, but I do think the best moments of the album are the ones where Lord is Lord.
Yes. Let Lord be Lord.
True. True. And in fact, I think, you know, that goes back to me, to the first album and a half, where my favorite stuff from the first album was almost all the stuff that came out on her sort of self-produced EP beforehand.
Yeah.
You know?
I can see that. I can see that.
So I do think, like, there is an element of our best shot with Lord is to just let her do her thing and not try to add much.
Yeah. I'm going to be very, very interested to see the commercial fortunes. You know, partly because it's my business, but I'm interested to see how this record winds up doing. Greenlight was not a big success.
And I'm a little surprised by that because I do think that song is a pretty quality pop song.
To me, it sounds like it could have been on the Working Girl soundtrack.
That seems unnecessarily harsh.
But the second single is Perfect Places, which is a more traditional Lord song. So we'll
okay.
curious to see yeah. how that does. You know, it's very interesting when you put out the last song in your record as a single. You don't see that very often.
Yeah. She also, just one last note on this, does some really cool stuff with her voice that I don't think we've heard before, just sort of fluttering around. And this is another voice where, like, whether she has perfect pitch is irrelevant to me because she's just interesting to sound to.
Yeah.
She is interesting to listen to, rather.
She has a really unique voice, too,
yeah.
I think. There's nobody else who quite sounds like Lord, although there have certainly been some imitators who've sprung Indeed. Up in her wake. All right, what do you think of the Phoenix album?
I think it's a Phoenix album, and I like Phoenix. You know what I mean? I like
sort of. Actually, I have a question about that because I would say I was generally disappointed in this record, and I feel like because I wanted more of a Phoenix album.
Huh.
But
it's the same bouncy pop rock. Like, what is missing for you?
The bounce. Yeah. Like, I thought.
Really?
Like, yeah. Like, I would describe this record as limp. You know?
Huh.
Like, the melodies were there, but it's not fun in the way that, you know, you really think of, you know, an Everything is Everything or Listomania or, you know, some of those.
Okay,
like,
well,
you know,
I'm not sure anything they've done since Wolfgang Amadeus Phoenix has reached that level.
Yeah. But like, but
I thought this was
the last record. I felt like they were that was ambitious and maybe didn't hit the mark. This record, I don't even feel like it's really trying anything. It's just kind of like here's some new wave synth keyboard and so some melody.
That's why I said I like it, not I love it. I mean, I'm not sure. Okay. So I said earlier about Fleet Foxes. I don't think a lot of the people who gave it great reviews could tell the difference song to song. Phoenix to me as a band a little bit occupies that territory, but in a way I'm not upset at.
Yeah, a little bit. They have a thing.
They have a thing.
But I think and when like, you look at Wolfgang Amadeus, you know, Phoenix.
Yes.
Like those songs are distinct. You know what I mean?
Yes. That's the best version of their thing.
Yeah.
But I feel like it's been a few albums, and maybe they took a little bigger swing last album, but I feel like it's been a couple of albums, hasn't it, where it's like, now this is our thing, and we just do it.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, but then you're the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
That's right. And the Red Hot Chili Peppers, while I haven't listened to them lately, like, I was still with them at Californication.
Yeah, well, then you'd probably still be with them because they just keep writing it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't like it as much. I mean, I'm really only with them at Blood Sugar Sex Magik, but still.
Okay. But yeah, that's what I mean is it's like, I'm not saying that you need to just make 1901 for the rest of time, although that would make me happy. But
right.
like, I, you know, if you're trying stuff and it's not succeeding, that's more interesting to me than this, which was just kind of like, I mean, the lead single I think is, you know, it's just because of you. Like, that's kind of like, I feel like
well,
that's about
sounds bad if you sing it like that,
but I okay. feel like that's about the effort that they're giving. It's like, all right, here's their keyboard riff and, you know, here's our melody. And then I don't know. It was,
yeah.
it felt very uninspired to me.
I don't think that's an unfair criticism. I just don't, I'm not, I think probably maybe the thing we're learning the most is that my expectations of Phoenix are lower than yours.
Perhaps. Perhaps. I've definitely liked a few Phoenix records in my day, and I've seen them play a bunch of times.
Yeah. I've never seen them play. They're French, right?
They are French, yes. Yeah. Still true.
That's all I got on Phoenix.
I got
Wolfgang Amadeus Phoenix, and they're French.
I'm surprised you didn't get a Sofia Coppola reference in there.
Oh, is she married to one of them or something?
I don't think they're married, but they've done a long-time couple, and I think they may have a kid. I don't know.
Interesting.
I
do enjoy Sofia Coppola. She has a new movie coming out, I believe.
That might be true. Maybe we'll talk about that at some point.
Yeah.
But first we're going to talk about Alt-J, because that's the last record on our list.
Uh-huh. I don't feel totally different about this record than I do about the Phoenix record, although it's harder to say exactly what an Alt-J album is. I don't feel like this is as good. I'm forgetting the name now, but their last album was excellent. Relaxer? Is that what it was called?
Yeah, I believe so.
I thought that album was excellent. I thought it sort of pushed the Alt-J thing to its best version, maybe. And this is like a little more low key, perhaps, but listenable enjoyable.
This record is called Relaxer. This is All Yours is the name of the
pre-prime. This is All Yours, yeah. And it had the huge single on it. I really, really liked that album. I find this one listenable and perfectly good. I only listened to this once, so I have less to say about it than some of the others.
I would agree with you that it is listenable and perfectly good. You know, to me, I'm a fan of An Awesome Wave.
It's short.
Which was the debut record. A lot of these records are short, which is nice. And I think the right move in 2017. Make a short record. You know,
make a short record, sell it for $8.
Yeah, like that's people who really want to get into you will get 12 songs, but most people want the best two or three right now.
Yep.
You know, and if you want to reach people, that's what you need. It's two or three really good songs. It's surprising how many of these records are lacking two or three really good songs.
Yeah, I do think the Lord record has that.
Yeah, but look, an awesome wave, which I really liked. From a songwriting standpoint, I agree. It's not as developed as a record. It's a little more of this quirky Radiohead light kind of thing. Whereas This Is All Yours is a full expansion to the sound.
Yeah.
I don't know what you would even call this third record, makes it sound worse than I think it is. It's not. Like, there's some pretty good songs. There's some very interesting things that happen. Yep. But it doesn't.
There sure are. There's some really. It does not lack for ambition in certain ways.
And it is a dynamic record.
Yes, very dynamic.
But it doesn't all work, I would say.
No, it does not.
No.
You said Radiohead light, and I think it's noteworthy that Radiohead didn't always work. They have a remarkably high hit rate.
Yeah.
But like, when you take swings, you occasionally miss. And I do think, like, it is noteworthy that this Alt-J record, you're not quite sure what it does, and it has some swings and misses, it does sound definitively somehow like an Alt-J record, and it is, like I said, good.
Yeah. I think every Alt-J record, I'm confident in saying that every Alt-J record they release between now and whenever they stop making records will sound like an Alt-J record. Like, they, those guys are doing a thing on their own.
Right.
And if you like that thing, then you'll be in on this. That's
totally.
You know what I mean? That's what it comes down to if you're thinking about whether or not you should check out this record.
Yup.
All right. I feel like we should probably get into homework.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So we're definitely going to talk about Orange is the New Black.
Yes, Julie Lake will officially join us next week, barring unforeseen complications. For those of you who watch Orange is the New Black, she plays Angie Rice, and she has a
fairly sizable role.
Yeah, sizable role increase, I would say, this season. So it's a great time to talk to her. And one thing I intend to ask her, and I'm bringing up now so that if I forget, you hopefully will remember, is it's so fascinating to me that she plays a character who is clearly an absolute piece of garbage as a human, just a terrible person. Downtrodden and sad in her own ways to some degree, but clearly an awful person. And yet, virtually every line she delivers, even this season as she's gotten more and more of them, is a comedy line.
Yeah. I mean, I cringe a little bit at the phrase absolutely terrible, in that I think one of the things that this show does well is give people humanity. Yeah.
Yes.
She's not a good person, certainly.
Okay, you know what I mean? Maybe that's too far.
Yeah.
She's clearly not a good person. She's clearly, like, there are things about her that obviously Julie as a human would find despicable.
Yes.
And I don't just mean that she has terrible teeth and a meth addiction.
And she does some terrible things. But there's also a lot of joy and, like, friendliness in her.
But
you
my
know what
point
I mean?
Is, like, a lot of times she's delivering kind of repulsive lines for comedic effect.
Right.
Which is like an interesting dichotomy to me. And like, you know, I wonder when you play someone like that who's clearly so far outside of Julie's experience, but also is, again, like a character that if you were going to like try to get method inside the head of that character, it's a messed up place, and yet almost everything she says is funny.
Yeah, indeed. All right.
So anyway, Orange is the New Black. I have loved this season. I don't know about you. Yeah. I've felt it's been clearly the best.
Oh, really?
Well, I don't know. That could be recency bias. I felt it's been excellent.
I'm going to save my opinion for next week.
Okay.
But I'm excited that that's an assignment because I've already finished it. So
yes, I'm a few episodes away from finishing it, but getting there.
One less thing I got to do. It goes down easy. I'm going to throw out another Netflix show, with Jenji Cohen's involvement, and that is Glow, which drops on Friday.
We will watch that because I've been very excited about it.
Yeah. No, I think that one's going to be good. So I would say watch a couple episodes of that. Have you been watching Handmaid's Tale at all?
A little. I'm only about 3 or 4 episodes in, but I'm not out. It's just, I think I'm out of the Americans, to answer your earlier question, at least for the time being. I'm not out on the show that we literally are just talking about.
Handmaid's Tale.
I've been watching a lot of stuff, including Orange is the New Black, and it's heavy, so it's tough to sit down in front of it, but I think it's very good.
Yeah, I try not to watch more than one a day, so I, you know, kind of piecemealing it out. But I'm just about done.
I would say you're just about done?
Yeah, so I'd like to check in on that at some point.
Okay, we may have to postpone that an extra week. I would like you to watch the first 2 episodes, I think, if you can, of I'm Dying Up Here.
Okay, is that on Showtime?
I believe it is.
All right, I can do that.
I heard a lot about it, and so I want to give it a try.
Sure. I mean, look, I think there's the obvious, like, man, there's a lot of shows about stand-up on TV right now. But I like stand-up, so I don't mind watching it.
But there's shows about stand-ups, and then there's, like, a show about stand-up comedy. You know what I mean?
No, that's like, exactly what I meant is I think there are a lot of shows about stand-up comedy on TV right now.
Really? Like, what else are you? Because I don't think of Louie or Crashing or... I don't think of those shows as about stand-up comedy.
I think of Crashing as very much about stand-up comedy. I also think about that the Amazon pilot that we watched that was a lot about comedy.
Oh, and it did get picked up, by the way. Yeah. I meant to mention that. It's officially picked up, so we will be able to talk about The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Yeah, you know what I mean? And both of those shows are there are many conversations about the craft of comedy in all of those shows.
I don't know if that's what I'm Dying Up Here is. I think it's as much a period piece about the 70s as anything.
All right. Well, so you've been watching that one?
I've seen 2 episodes.
Okay.
And I think there have only been 3 or 4, so.
We've got a lot of homework on the board already, but there are 2 more things that I would like to talk about at some point. Hope we'll do that in the future. There's a new season of Orphan from Black, which is a show that we've talked about before.
Yep, I have started that. It is still a show that I love, and I still think Tatiana Maslany is the most criminally underrated actress on television, but it has gotten pretty confusing.
Indeed. And that's
pretty confusing.
Not really a recent phenomenon. It's been that way for a minute.
It has, but it's like when I think it did get more complicated last season. And having the, like, however long off in between, like, getting back into the first episode was a challenge for me.
I'm just at the don't think about it too hard stage.
that's reasonable. That's probably the best approach.
I'm just like, you know what? I'm just going with it. So there's that. And then you don't actually have to watch any more of this, but I would like to have, in light of recent events, a Bachelor franchise discussion. So
what recent events?
Oh, you're not following any of this.
Is it news about The Bachelor? Then no, I am not following it.
Well, it was kind of a big deal. There may or may not have been a sexual assault on The Bachelor.
What?
They shut down production for 3 weeks on Bachelor in Paradise. There were some lawsuits and things.
Not with the nice young woman that I saw on
that's The Bachelorette. That's The Bachelorette. This is the show that was supposed to air after this. So,
So no one has seen any of it or even knows who's on it.
Well, people know who's on it because they've revealed some of the cast, and now the story's out there, and, you know, I mean, like, people know a lot of stuff now.
Do people know who is being accused of sexual assault?
Yes, yes. People know who the alleged victim and the alleged perpetrator are. Now, Warner did an investigation and found that there was not sexual assault, and they are resuming production on the season, which I think was a shock to many of us. And anyway,
they're resuming production.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, there is a lot to talk about.
Who accused each other of sexual assault still on the show? Like,
I do not know that yet. So there,
oh my God, that's shameless.
I doubt that they're coming back because there is certainly pending litigation. So there's that, and then there's just the dynamics of this particular season of The Bachelorette, which is, you know, covering some new ground for the show.
When you say covering some new ground, you're talking about having a black woman on it?
Well, I mean, they've had black women on the show, but having...
But, I mean, as The Bachelorette?
Yeah. Yeah, indeed. So...
Yeah. By the way, I have to say, I don't know if I said this, but great, good for her. The most striking thing about watching the one episode that I did is how much it really doesn't matter what race The Bachelorette is, it's still the same dumb show with the same dumb people on it.
Well, yes and no.
Like, you can tell me about lawyers and everything, whatever. There's dumb lawyers out there, and those are the ones that go on The Bachelorette.
I am not here to tell you that the people on the show are not dumb. I'm not here to tell you that. So anyway, there's a lot of text and subtext on the show that makes it a really fun conversation. And I would like to have that conversation at some point.
If you're prepared to, like, give me any and all information I need within the conversation, then we can do that. But I'm not doing any research.
Okay. That's fair.
I abjectly refuse to spend my abundant free time reading about anything Bachelor or Bachelorette related.
Are you sure? Because I have many articles that I can send you.
I bet you do.
All right. We got to get going. Let's put a bow on this. And,
all right. So Handmaid's Tale.
So much homework, dude. So much homework.
Yeah, a lot of homework. But really, I'm dying up here. Orange is the New Black and Glow, I think, are the priorities, right?
Indeed.
Okay. Indeed. I think I can handle that. And enjoy the NBA draft tonight.
I cannot wait. It's the first time that I really feel like – I shouldn't say the first time. But it's the first time in a while where I feel like that thing could go any direction tonight. You know what
totally.
I mean?
And I'll just say, like, we'll have to do our basketball discussion – once, you know, a few weeks down the road, once free agency gets going. But I think it's going to be one heck of a discussion because stuff's going to keep happening. It's crazy right now in the NBA. It's a great time to be a basketball fan.
It is, unless you root for the Wolves. You know, if they take Markkanen, like, revolt. Just revolt.
Whoever takes Markkanen,
revolt.
The whole fan base is getting pissed.
I really feel
which
like he's
I think
be...
is probably unfair to that kid at this point.
I'm praying he's a Nick.
That would be the most hilarious result, that's for sure.
It would be the best. All right, yeah. I will talk to you later.
Bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed, the light's out. Butter's getting hard, the eggs are cooling, and the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor, have yourself a tremendous evening.